Your name?
Chuck Hicks.
Chuck, we're here at the Freedom Plaza for the Occupy, the occupation of Freedom Plaza. It's day one. But feel free to offer your thoughts on that, but I'd like to talk to you about the upcoming unveiling of the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial, someone who came up in the civil rights movement. I know you've been working hard to organize for this event, and you have a lot of the history coming from the civil rights movement, so I'm interested in your thoughts on it.
Well, first of all, I think the movement is a tribute not just to Dr. King, but to all the men and women of all races and creeds and colors who fought for the freedom of the privileges of democracy for everybody in this country. So I see the memorial as a symbol of the civil rights movement in terms of what it represents. And that King, of course, was one of the most visible people in the movement. But in terms of all the lives that were given, all the sacrifices that were made, all the foot soldiers who were unknown, that this is a memorial to them. That we recognize the sacrifices that so many made who were not in the spotlight, but who made it happen. If it had just been for King, or if it had just been for James Farmer and Ralph Abernathy and Stokely Carmichael and Julian Bond and all the other well-known civil rights leaders, there would not have been a movement. It would not have succeeded. The movement succeeded and is as successful as it has been because of the people. That if you have leaders and leaders have ideas and they take the first step, but you have to have somebody who's going to believe in what you believe in or believe in the same that you believe in and are willing to try to make it happen. So that's what I see the memorial being as a statement to not only Dr. King's effort, but to all the people in the civil rights movement and their efforts. And I particularly limit that primarily to the civil rights movement. Though with Dr. King, he moved past the civil rights movement and became a fighter for social justice, which is a different perspective of a struggle for all people. But in terms of the oppression of people of color in this country, this memorial symbolizes that.
You knew Dr. King?
Not personally, but I had a chance to meet him a couple of times. I met him a couple of times in Mississippi when I was doing some work in Mississippi. I found him to be a very interesting man. I didn't spend a lot of time with him. I remember one time asking him in Mississippi if he ever got scared. And he said, well, I think every man gets scared. But you continue to do what you believe in. And that thought sort of stuck with me. And I think I've asked all kinds of people that I've met who've been leaders if they ever had any fear, even including my dad. And he said, yeah, you know, if you're human, you got to be scared. But fear is not the driving force. There's something more important than fear that drives you. And so you're willing to face the fear in terms of what you believe in.
Talk about your dad.
Well, my dad was, I think, an extraordinary man. He did a couple of things. He's probably most noted for his role with the Deacons for Defense and Justice. And as you know, the Deacons were the first black group to carry guns in the Civil Rights Movement for self-protection. Now, that concept came out of Greenboro, Louisiana, and not Bogalusa. But they came down and established a chapter in Bogalusa. And at one point when my dad was keeping, my family was keeping the white civil rights workers in our house, the civil rights worker, there were two whites and one black, and they had what you call days of testing where they were testing public accommodations. And after that event had happened, the chief of police came down and said that a mob of 300 white men were forming on the main street of town and coming to lynch my family if we did not get civil rights workers out. My dad had a confrontation with the chief of police, who later said, who said that he could not give our family any protection. So my dad said, if you can't give us protection, I'll get my own. And so he had my dad, he had my sister call two or three of his friends. They called other black men. And eventually there must have been 75 black men in our house, on our roof, in trees, and in neighbors' porches and stuff, guarding our house. They were able, the civil rights workers there were able to get a telephone call out to New Orleans before they turned off all the phones in the black community. And so the press got the word and they came down. And when they saw that morning, when they saw all these black men with guns, they asked my dad, who are these men? He said, they're the Deacons for Defense and Justice. And that's really how Bogalusa got the spotlight for the Deacons and maintained it. But my dad was filed a number of suits that became instrumental in, throughout the civil rights movement, not only in Bogalusa, but throughout the country. He filed a suit against Carl Heath versus Crown Dulleback. I guess it was done on Title III or Title VII, that forced them to desegregate all the cleanup areas in factories throughout this country. Because in many places, blacks had wash-up areas and whites had wash-up areas, and that was not only in the South, that was throughout the country. And so he was noted for doing that. One of the other things that he did was he filed a suit that forced HUD. HUD used to decide where they would put public housing. And they had decided they were going to build public housing in a neighborhood, in an African-American neighborhood. And they decided that they would put it there. And they didn't consult the community or anything. And my dad, through his attorneys, filed a suit and got an injunction that forced HUD. They had the pliers and everything there to start construction, and the injunction came through. And basically what it says now is that you can't walk into any neighborhood in the community and just decide, I'm going to put public housing here. That you have to go through a process, and you have to work with that community. You can't just put all public housing in certain neighborhoods anymore. If you go, for people who are lawyers, I'm not sure the correct term, but they're dockets. And when you look in, you're looking up a case about an issue, you can go to certain issues for references. And I am told that during the civil rights era that there must be 40 or 50 cases cited called Hicks versus that in terms of statutes that they argued in other situations because of the situations that my dad found a man of foul. So he was an extraordinary man with just a high school education, but he had good common sense. He believed in the Constitution. He understood the Constitution. I remember one time that the chief of police came down and said to my dad that he wanted to take the guns out of our house. My dad says, you can't do that. The Constitution gives every man the right to bear arms. This is my home. And you can't go against the Constitution. You can't take the guns out of my house. You know? And he was that kind of a man in terms of how he looked at things and how he looked at issues. And one of the things that he did, I think, that helped Bogalusa and Washington Parish was that he worked and set out and put together a plan for the movement. It wasn't just we're going to demonstrate for this. He had a plan. One was public accommodation. Another piece of the plan was integrated schools. Another was an economic plan in terms of hiring. And so there were pieces of this plan that he wanted to implement so that there would be a full piece of integration in terms of what you achieve. That didn't always work, and it didn't always work with the whole movement itself. But at least in his mind, along with a lot of other people, there was that you had to have a plan, that the movement, as any movement, just can't be something that just takes off. You have to understand the struggle, You have to understand what you're dealing with. You have to understand ways in terms of how you're going to attack that problem. And so my dad, with the Bogalusa Voters League, put together a plan for Washington Parish in terms of the kinds of things and the kinds of lawsuits that they filed that had repercussions not only in Bogalusa, but the state of Louisiana and sometimes throughout the country.
Was your dad's life ever threatened?
Oh, many times. They built a casket on the main street of town and said, "Here lies that hick, that nigger Hicks," you know. And there was a casket there for him. They hung him in effigy. I know one particular case, they tried to hire somebody to assassinate my dad. And that's probably one of the few times that I saw my mother fall apart. And my mother was right with my dad throughout this whole process. I think the sad part was about we were having dinner. And as much as we could, we had grown up as a family that we did a lot of stuff together as a family. And one of the things we did was we always ate together. We always had a family prayer together on Sunday and those sort of things. So even with the movement going on, there would be times when my mother would bring us all to the table and we'd have dinner together. I remember we were having dinner as a family along with other people in the house. And somebody came and called my dad and some men out to tell him that there was a man who was telling people, had told some people that some whites had paid him, had offered him, paid him $50 to kill my father. And they had gotten the word of it, and they came to my father and told him about it. And of course, the deacons and black men in Bogalusa sort of took that matter in their hands. I was in high school, but it never happened, suffice that to say. I think one of the things that we were privy to, and I don't know if it was good or bad, was that whatever was happening in the movement, we were totally involved in it. We were probably one of the few families, I know the only family in Bogalusa, but probably one of the, when you look throughout the South and look at the total families that were involved in the movement, and I don't mean just the father or the mother, but the whole family. We were one of those families, whatever my parents did, we did. Because we were a family, we did everything together. When my parents got in the movement, we automatically knew that we were in it. We came home from school, and my dad would say, "Okay, get some picket signs. We're going down to picket. You know, we're going to be marching to City Hall. Let's go." Now other kids came home. If they wanted to go picket, they could go picket. If they wanted to go march, they could. And they had a choice. We didn't have a choice. But we never saw it as not having a choice. We just saw it as this is what the mom and dad is doing, and what they do, we do. I once asked my brother years later, I said, "Greg, if you had a chance to do this all over again, in terms of the movement," my brother helped integrate one of the schools, the high school in Bogalusa. And I asked him, "Would he do it again?" He said, "Absolutely not." He said, "But if I was a Hicks, I'd do it again, because as a Hicks, we did that. But if I wasn't a Hicks and I had a choice knowing what I know now," he said, "I wouldn't do it." And I asked him why. He said, "Because the sacrifice was so much. And people didn't appreciate all the stuff that you had to go through. That you gave up a lot. You couldn't be in a high school. You couldn't play football. You couldn't be in a drama club. When you integrated schools, you gave up all those kinds of things. And then you were isolated. It was just you. You couldn't join the clubs at the white high school that was segregated. You were just there to go to school. And then you always had to fight. Every day they had to fight. And this was no exception. And then when you came back, for a lot of different reasons, you became a segregated group of kids, where when we grew up, our house was like a YMCA in our community and in our neighborhood. That's where everybody came for the summer to play ball, to listen to the radio, to have a little yard parties and all that sort of stuff. But once my parents got into the movement, it became different. And people would tell their kids, I don't want you at the Hicks' houses anymore. Because they didn't want to be associated with us. So we, friends that we had, we had to give up friends, you know. And parents were strict about their kids not coming down to our house because of, they worked for Miss Jones, and if Miss Jones found out that their kids were associating with her, they could lose their jobs. And so you give up a lot. And then just psychologically, that's the pressure you went in. And then you had groups of people, of kids in the African-American community who looked at you differently. Well, you thank you so much because you're integrating the schools and all that. And then so you had all kinds of isolations that you had to go through. And you didn't have a lot of friends. You couldn't go out and play. We were a marked family. We couldn't go anyplace without somebody taking us. We were a marked family. And we were a small town, so everybody knew the Hicks family. They knew our car, and they knew us, and they had taken pictures of us and all that. So, you know, our life was just totally different. It was just turned upside down. And so my brother says that, you know, the sacrifices was just required so much that if he had his choice personally, he would not have done it. But as a member of our family, he'd do it again because that was what we were doing. I once asked my dad about us as a family. And I said, you know, Daddy, you know, do you think we were an extraordinary family? I say, you know, when I look at us as a family and where we started off and all the things we used to do as a family, and you know, we weren't rich or anything. We were just a working class family, but we went on picnics, we went fishing together, we went crabbing. We just did things as a family. We ate together. We played slow motion football as a family. We'd get in our living room on a Saturday night and put on a record player, and we'd all dance. My mama, my daddy, my brothers, we'd all dance with each other. People come by and think we were having a party, but it was just us as a family. And then all of a sudden we got into the movement and all that changed. It just fell apart. We didn't sleep in beds anymore. We didn't eat together as a family. We couldn't play, couldn't do anything. And so I said, you know, do you think we to go through all of this and then to come out and still be sane and the family comes back together? He said, I don't think we were any different than any other family. We were an ordinary family that God prepared for extraordinary times to come. He said, but we were no different than any other family in Bogalusa. You know, that we had bills to pay. We had problems, you know. We were black, we were discriminated against, we had no privileges. And we were not an educated family. We were not a family that was middle class. We were a poor family, a working family. You know, we had to budget our money. We couldn't shop in the better stores. We put stuff on layaway, you know. We budgeted. So we were just an ordinary family that God decided that this family can be an example for other families, for other people. And that's been our situation from the beginning. Even when we were growing up in a black school, we went to black schools, I did, and my sisters, and sometimes we were pointed out because teachers had the privilege of being teachers, and so most families, at the most, the parent might have finished high school or they went to high school. But when a teacher said something or did something, that was it. And my parents had an attitude that they did not want us mistreated as kids by teachers. They did not want us picked on. And teachers had a way of having picks and specials, and that was okay, but don't mistreat us. And so we had a reputation that the Hicks kids thought that they were special, that nobody could do anything to them. And so a lot of black teachers wanted his head, because we were a challenge. And so we stood up to that. If they did something to us, my mother would say, I don't mind you disciplining them, but don't mistreat them, you know? A teacher one day grabbed me, shook me, and told me, stop pushing in line, you're acting like a nigger. I said, I'm not a nigger, and my mama said, nobody calls me a nigger, and I took off running. I must have been in about third or fourth grade. There must have been three or four teachers trying to run after me to get me. I got home, I told my mother was always like this. My mother got up, she got dressed, she put on her heels, a dress, lipstick, and went to that school, went to the principal, brought that teacher in and said, don't you ever call my son out of his name. Said, I will take you and beat you to a pulp. Said, my child is not a nigger. Don't you ever do that. So we had this reputation that we grew up fighting all our lives. So a fight was nothing for us, you know, and it's still nothing. Even here in the city, you know, fight ain't nothing for me. I grew up fighting. I've been struggling all my life for injustices. And so, and I've been lucky enough to, in this city, to have known all kinds of people and rubbed shoulders with all kinds of people. But I know that I'm no better than anybody else, and I constantly remind people sometimes that they're no better than anybody else. When I used to have parties, and I don't do it anymore, but when I had a party, the wonderful thing about my party was I had all kinds of people there. I had people who were homeless. There might be people there who were very rich. There were people there who were in the union. There were people there who were church members. There were people there who were straight, who were gay. It was just whatever. Because I like people, and people are no different from each other. And so I've always seen my role, a part of my role in life is that God gives you challenges, and God sometimes has roles for people. And God has, you know, God cares about everybody. But God sometimes, life, picks out people to do certain things. Because I'm spiritual, I say God has a role for me. The role for me is to do certain things. There might be another role he has for somebody. He has favorites. He has favorites in terms he wants certain people to do certain things. Like he might say, Pete, you know, your role is to be picked on and pushed about by the establishment because you take on this role of making the issues of people who are oppressed, who can't speak for themselves. You know, that's the role I have for you. And doesn't mean that you have an easy role, but it's a role that he has given you because he knows that you can do it, that you can handle it. He's chosen you to do that. And he gives you insight, he gives you wisdom, and he gives you the ability to learn and to educate so that you can grow in that role. You know, I can look at the issues and things that I did when I was at Syracuse University as the first black student body president. I might would address differently today, but I did what I did and I knew what I knew, but I wasn't afraid to stand up for that issue. And just today, with this Take Back Wall Street, and the issue here, I think it's just an incredible opportunity for us here in D.C. To join this movement, to take back D.C., because the primary thing about this movement here in Freedom Plaza is that these are issues that affect us here in D.C., and for no other reason that these are people from all over the world, all over the country, who are concerned about Wall Street, about the rich, about how Congress lets people control them. And the fact that if these people are here, we ought to be a part of this fight, because if we can be a part of their fight and tell them about the fight for statehood, they'll join our fight. That they will take this fight up. This is an injustice that they can relate to. And for us in this city not to come and be a part of this is our loss. And every citizen, every person who believes in statehood, who supports the belief of Dr. King and all the other leaders throughout this country, who have fought for what's right, we ought to be down here. And sometimes there are different ways that you support a fight. I mean, one of the things that I have now is that I'm thinking about is that, you know, we ought to be doing for the people here what we did for people when I was Resurrection City. People are coming here and they were fighting for the poor, and there were certain church groups and certain people and people who cared who brought food down every day. And there should be no reason why the people who are here should have to buy water, should have to buy fruit, should not have to worry about cover if it gets cold. We're the whole city for this. We should be doing this. Now, this is our struggle. This is not their struggle. This is our struggle. And it's more our struggle because we have a double-edged hit in here. We can't make any decisions because Congress runs everything we do because we're not a state and we don't have any rights. And then secondly, Wall Street controls Congress. And when Wall Street controls and the banks control Congress, they control the country, and we're part of the country. So we got a double-edged hit on this. So we ought to be a part of this. And it's just like the reason that I chaired and took on a chair of the host committee for Dr. King, for the dedication. It seems to me that what's important as a city is that at that point in time, you had 300,000 people coming into the city, and they were coming to honor Dr. King. And the people who are coming here were believers in what Dr. King fought, and are humanitarians, who are activists, who are communicators, and all of that. And as a whole city, when people come here, the first thing they were going to say is, when they go back, people are going to say, how was the dedication? If they were a mile away, or if they had a special seat, they were going to say, it was great. The next thing they were going to say, well, how was D.C.? And they're going to say, oh, D.C. is tired. It wasn't about nothing. And so for us in the city, the first thing we should have done and should have been preparing to do, we should have played host to all the people who were coming here. And by playing host, we should have had things that people, you should have welcomed people. We should have had events going on that were free, because everything that the foundation did had a cost to it. And so what we ended up doing in a very short time was putting together a coalition of community groups, political groups, church groups, to put together a host committee. And that host committee's role, as it is now, is to provide, one, free activities for people coming to the city, as well as the citizens, to make people feel good about the city. Two, we put together a brochure that talks about all the free events, talks about the history of D.C., talks about Black historic landmarks, talks about historic neighborhoods, and then it points out the problems that we as a city have because we are not a state. And that this is a brochure that, and it's a souvenir that people can take back. They can appreciate it, they can show it. It has pictures and historic landmarks in this brochure, and then it has our plea about the role of the city and why we're not a state and what people can do to help us become a state. And so we thought that this is something the city really should have done, but it did not. And so sometimes you don't wait for people to do things when you know you can do them yourself, and that it's important for me that this D.C. become a state. It's important for the children, for young children coming up, for you, for senior citizens, for people who are addictive on drugs, and the fact that the city says we won't support needle exchange, even if it helps to cut down HIV. And so these issues become important to me. And if I can find a way to make people appreciate the city and want to do that fight, then I don't wait for the city to do that. I think it's something the city should have had the vision to see. But that's either here or there. I think we take what you take, you put together what you can, you put together, and you do what you can do. And what I'm pleased about, there have been so many people throughout the city who responded to the host committee, that we had a coalition of people, of about 80-some people, who came to meetings, who were part of a meeting, who spread the word out, who talked to people, and for the people who came here, there were activities, there were WPFW, was a wonderful host radio station. It did serious programs in terms of panels and discussions that educate people about the civil rights movement, leaders in the civil rights movement. We had panel discussions at the library. We had panel discussions and tours at the library as well as the African American Civil War Museum. We're going to repeat a lot of those things beginning Thursday of next week and run them until the 16th. And so once again, you know, I think it's our obligation to sell the city. And we can't wait for the city to do what it should do, or should be a part of doing. And I'm pleased to see that the city has come together and said they want to have a march about statehood. But I applaud that, and I think we as citizens ought to come together and support that march, because it speaks volumes for us, because Dr. King believed in statehood. And if Dr. King believed in it, and came to this city many times to fight for statehood. So it's indicative that in terms of our respect for Dr. King, that we as a city ought to show up in large numbers. It would be embarrassing if only 1,000 people showed up for a march for statehood in memory of Dr. King. You know, Dr. King, where he was, he could vote. But he understood the value and the importance of fighting for statehood for the city. It's the same theory, analogy in my mind, of whites who gave up their lives, whites who fought, who marched in the civil rights movement, who got beat, who got stabbed, who got bit by dogs, who got all those things happening to them. And whites didn't have to do that, because wherever they went, they were white. They are white. And as a privilege, be you in the South, or be you in the East, or be you in the West, if you're white, there's a carte blanche card. And to turn that card in and say, I'm gonna march with blacks, I'm gonna stand up for blacks, because it's the right thing to do, is an incredible concept for me to take in and try to absolve, to make those kinds of sacrifices. And it's difficult for me to sometimes understand why whites would do that when they didn't have to do that, except for the fact, the principle that they believe in the goodness of man and what is right. Because me, I have to do it, because I don't have that privilege. I have to fight for that privilege every day. You know, every day I am black in America, I am black in DC. And I can tell the difference of what the city used to be like and what it's like now. And I can look at not only that, but for another group of whites, and a great deal of the whites who were in the movement were whites who were college students, who came out of middle-class families. And so they had privileges. They had credit cards. They had the things that poor whites did not have. And so for them to come in and to make those sacrifices and to do that is an extraordinary commitment to mankind. And for me, to look at what Dr. King stood for in terms of fighting for the rights of state rights for D.C. to be a state, it's the same principle that whites came into the civil rights movement for, that he's in a state where he could elect legislators, because he had a vote, and he had black votes. And to come to the city to fight for that, and for us not to want to fight for that, it's an amazing concept that means we really need to spend some time educating ourselves and the value of what it is to have pride in what's important to you.
Chuck Hicks, I want to follow up with 2 points about down in Mississippi, but before that, do you have any final thoughts about the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial unveiling October 16th?
I think it's an important event. I think that while they don't expect the numbers to come from out of town because of a lot of different things, because of people's money expenses, because hotels are full, a whole lot of things. But I see absolutely no reason why we could not bring 100,000 people from Maryland, D.C., and Virginia to this dedication. There's just absolutely no reason. If 300,000 people were willing to come to spend money, and there were another million people who would have liked to have been here, but couldn't be here because they didn't have money, they didn't have transportation, they the health wise or whatever. And for us to be here, and all we have to do is get up and come out. There's absolutely no reason why 100,000 people from Maryland, D.C., and Virginia should not come out to celebrate this march and the struggle that Dr. King and the symbol and what it represents for all the people in this country from which we've come and how far we've come, and to remember that the struggle still goes on. And so I am just hoping and urging that people have a sense of loyalty to the struggle and come out.
Going back to Mississippi, I think that's where you said you had met King. What were you doing down there?
I had organized. I was actually the first African-American student body president at Syracuse University. And we had brought Charles Everett, Mega Everett's brother, to Syracuse to speak. And he is, by way of distant cousin. But and he was talking about part of the problem that the South has is that blacks and people from the North come to Northern schools, get an education, and stay, that they don't go back and contribute to their communities. And he said to me, he said, you're up here. He said, now you know your daddy and folks in Bogalusa struggling.
Here,
he said, but what do you, he said, why don't you bring some people, why don't you organize some students and come to Fayette, Mississippi, and to Jackson, and if you bring them, I'll put them up. And so we organized students from the East, from Syracuse and other universities, and they spent a summer in Mississippi working. And part of that summer, King came through, and so I got a chance to meet him. But I met Fannie Lou Hamer there. We built a park, we did voter registration, we had a freedom school, and Syracuse was the base, but we had kids from New York, NYU, from Colgate, just kids heard about it and came. And we brought, I think it was three or four cadres of students who came and spent 2 weeks. There was a guy named Rick Westcott from Westchester. He came and stayed all summer. He was one of the coordinators. And so we were able to come to Mississippi to do some voter registration, to do some education, but also it was an experience for students who were privileged to come in and see a different way of life and see what people live, how people live. And they stayed with families. And when they stayed with a family, they might have stayed in a house, in a shotgun house. And they slept, some of them slept in a room on a couch. And there was only three rooms in the house. There was the kitchen, a front room, and a middle room. And they stayed in a house where there was an outside toilet. And or people had to take a bath in a number three tub, which you know nothing about.
No, I don't.
But and those conditions somehow still exist. They exist in West Virginia. I spent one summer working in West Virginia with the migrant workers. And that's another area of poverty. And so I have been lucky enough to always have a job, to be able to pay some rent and buy some food, but that has never been enough for me in terms of what I can contribute and what I can give. And so it's a struggle that I am grateful to be in. I feel blessed that the Lord, the Spirit, chose me as somebody that can make a difference, can help make a difference.
What's a number three tub?
A number three tub is a big tub that you put water in. It's like they would have a foot. You ever see the old Westerns when they have that big steel tub, mm-hmm. and the cowboys come in and they pour hot water in and take a bath? Well, a number three tub is a round tub. It was the largest tub that they made. And you could actually put a person could actually sit in it. And they pour water in it, and that's how you bathe. Before you had bathtubs. A shower.
You mentioned Medgar Everett's brother. Can you say who
Charles Everett.
Medgar Everett was?
Medgar Everett was head of the NAACP in Mississippi. And, of course, his house was bombed and he was killed. And when he was killed, his brother, who was more of a businessman in Mississippi, took his brother's place in the fight, Charles Everett.
Lastly, you were talking about growing up and how one of the things you couldn't do was sleep in your own bed. Did I understand that correctly?
Well, during the Civil Rights Movement, we, as a family, you know, our house was the central house for the movement in Bogalusa. And so our whole world changed, my whole lifestyle changed. You know, we had a modest three-bedroom house. We had lived in a shotgun house with three rooms, a kitchen, a mill room, and a front room. My parents lived in the state of bedroom was in the front room, and the children's rooms, we had bunk beds. So we had two sets of bunk beds. And so we each had our own bed. Unlike a lot of places, when there were a three-bedroom house, there was a bed, or two beds in the middle room, and if there were five children, all five children slept in those two beds. We were lucky enough to have had separate beds all our lives. And so when we moved into our home, that was a modest three-bedroom house. We each had a room. There was a boys' room, a girls' room. My parents had their room. So once the Civil Rights Movement got started, well, number one, because oftentimes there were the bedrooms, one of the bedrooms were, some of the bedrooms, and one is in the front of the house. You couldn't, in my parents' room, for example, you couldn't sleep in there because the bed was near the window. So if people tried to drive by and shoot, you couldn't do that. And also if people, because we kept a lot of the civil rights workers there, we kept volunteers there, and when we, people who had been up all night or people who had been patrolling, they came in, they needed a place to sleep, they got in a bed. And so we gave up one room for civil rights workers. And then all of us then slept in one room. I say, in terms of having, it was a boys and girls room. But as the movement grew and more people came in, you know, it was just, our house was full. And so we didn't have a bed. You know, we slept on the floor, or we slept next door at my aunt's house, or wherever we could sleep. And so we were not used to those kinds of things. We were an organized poor family. You know, we went to church together. We had family activities. We read books together. You know, we did all those kinds of things. But all that changed, the whole lifestyle changed because we were in a movement. We were in a, people were getting beat up. People were getting shot. People were coming to the house. The civil rights workers were coming there. We were feeding people. So we didn't get a chance to sit down and eat dinner every day. And so my mom could say, tell us what happened at school. Tell us how your day went. So whatever I had done wrong, my sister had heard about it. She could go back and tell my mother what she heard I did at school so I could get chastised for it. But so all those things changed. Our whole world changed. And it was an adjustment, you know. And we didn't have time that we spent with each other anymore. We didn't spend time as a family for 5 years. We just were not a family anymore. And we didn't live as a family. But we functioned as a bigger family in terms of all the people who were there. And so all the people who were in the movement became part of a family. And of course, we were children, and they saw us as protecting us as children. So even today, we see people who were in the movement, and they see us as part of their children, as children. So it was a different lifestyle, a change for us. But you know, it was worth the effort.
Chuck Hicks, lastly, your father passed away of natural causes very recently, or yeah, within the last couple of years.
Last year, in April.
Last year, and the New York Times did a major piece. But are you surprised that he was able to live his full natural life, and any final thoughts that you have?
Well, you know, I was. A couple of things. One is that my dad died, and you're right, the New York Times did a front page story on him in the obituary section. We've been able to get a street named after him. The Museum of Black American History and Culture has included not him, but the entire Hicks family to be a part of the Civil Rights Section and the first phase of it, of the museum, and we're honored by that. Part of that had to do with, I wrote a proposal saying that I thought when the museum did a piece about the Civil Rights Movement, that to understand the movement, you had to know that the movement was in different phases, and that the movement was different in a small town as it was in Atlanta. And so the things that happened in and the resources in Atlanta, you didn't have in a small town like Bogalusa, someplace in Mississippi or Arkansas. Those are small towns were different. You didn't have, for example, we only had one church in Bogalusa during the movement that we could go to. None of the other churches would let us come into there, not even our own church would have let us come and use the church as a meeting place. But that was not, I mean, that was just the way it was in small towns for a lot of different reasons. So I thought it was important that the museum showcase not only the movement from major cities, but what it was like for small towns and people in small towns. And I thought also that the reason that because my dad had done the stuff with the deacons and some of his cases were landmark, and he was not a lawyer. He did not have a major organization behind him like NAACP or SCLC. But these cases and this effort was fought primarily by a local civil rights group in Bogalusa, the community itself, with sometimes the support of CORE. And so for those reasons, I thought it was important that the civil rights movement be looked at from that perspective also, so that we can get a better picture of the movement. Oftentimes, people talk about the civil rights movement, and they still don't understand that the civil rights movement was not just in the South. That the civil rights movement took place in California with the Black Panther Party in Oakland. The civil rights movement took place in Boston when they were trying to desegregate the schools. The civil rights movement took place here in D.C. With Julius Hobson, forcing them to spend more money on black schools than they were on white schools. So the whole civil rights movement was across this country, but we like to pigeonhole it into just the South. So I thought it was important that at least initially that the Museum of African American History and Culture do a piece about civil rights in small Southern towns and interview people. And then secondly, I thought that perhaps they ought to look at my dad and our family, because we were one of the few families, the only family in Bogalusa, who the whole family was involved. You know, my brothers integrated schools, my brother and my sister led the marches out of the high schools. I got kicked out of Southern University because of my dad's activity with the march. I ended up going to Syracuse, where I started SNCC on campus and all that sort of stuff. So I thought those were the reasons that I thought that if you can find a family or use our family or other families, because those are exceptions. And then finally, I was pleased and considered that we have been a blessed family, that to have. One day I was sitting down and I was thinking about the movement and all the, and what it was like when we were a family, and we went on picnics together and did all these things as a family. And then all of a sudden we were in the movement and everything was helter-skelter. And then after 6 or 8 years of that, however long it was, that our family was able to come back and try to put the pieces back together and to live again. And I thought it was absolutely remarkable that to have come through the stuff that we had come through and still remain sane has been an incredible blessing, because just psychologically, to see your father go to work every day and never know that this is the day he might not come back, because even though the deacons took him to work, there was a place when he had to get out and go into that factory. And my father never missed a day of work doing the whole civil rights movement. I want to see that when he came out, before they could pick him up, there were all kinds of places that he could have been shot. And the fact that we knew that people were being hired to kill him. But not only that, to know that my brothers and sisters had to go to school every day and to fight every day and to be called niggers and to have teachers mistreat them. And not only in the white schools, but in the black schools. My sister was an honor student all her life, and she was a Dillard. And one of the professors at Dillard said, the people who were leading the civil rights movement are nothing but niggers and trash. And my sister got up and ate him alive, and he flunked her. And she was an honor student, and he refused to pass her. And the dean of the department, and he refused to change that grade. And he had to take that course over psychologically to continually to have to do all of that and to see people and have them to worry every day about each other, to go on a march. When they integrated a park in Bogalusa, the police put dogs on my brother, and the hospitals refused to treat him. They'd take him to New Orleans. All those kind of things that you live with and you can't forget, and that to somehow be able to put that in the back of your mind, to be able to come back together and to begin to function as a family, to recreate your family closeness, to continue to care about each other, and then still to be an example for other people in the family, and to continue with all the other kinds of tragedies that have happened to us. I have found that it was a blessing that my dad was able to live to be 81, 82, to see his children finish school, to see his grandchildren finish school, and to see his grandchildren not only go to his children become the first generation of college kids, but then to see his children, his grandchildren go to schools like Yale and Cornell and Princeton, and to see his grandchildren become doctors and attorneys, and to see his son become head of the union in the city, to have met all kinds of leaders and all of that, and to just be blessed with the fruits of a struggle, not financially but otherwise, that I think that that was incredible joy for him. I think it's been a joy for us as brothers and sisters to see us come through that. If I ever get a chance to finish a book, I'm writing a book and it's called Something to Shout About. It talks about what it was like as a family to go through a civil rights movement, to come out saying. There's an old Negro saying, and it said, that's something to shout about when something good comes out for you. It says something to shout about. And so I thought that what had happened to us, where we started, and my family started off incredibly poor, to be able to get to finish school, to get their kids through school, get into the movement, do all that sort of stuff, to get their kids educated, to do all that, and still to be alive, to be sane, and to still and to deal with the mental challenges that you have. My sister said to me, my youngest sister who's now passed, said to me 5 years before she died that it was, she must have been 40 before she stopped having nightmares about the civil rights movement. My brothers and sisters, and everyone, my brothers and sisters say that they have nightmares. And when I say stop having nightmares, I mean constant nightmares, that something can happen and you got a flashback that's never going to end for you. You'd be just walking. And all of a sudden, sometimes I see here in D.C., and I see park police on horses. And I got a flashback of the police on the horses in a park trying to ride over kids. You're not going to lose those. And so I think it's been a blessing for us to have come through this and still be able to function. I'm also reminded sometimes of what Amuma Baraka was once known as Leroy Jones said. He said that, said two things. He said if blacks ever took time to concentrate on the cruelty of slavery and really what that was all about, what it was like, feeding you like hogs, branding you, beating you, raping you, just everything. The trip from all that said, if you took time and spent time on that, you would go absolutely insane. And I think that the same thing for people who have struggled through the Holocaust and all those kinds, and American Indian and Native American. If he takes time to think about what this country did to him, he would go in absolutely insane. And that for those who have spent a lot of time thinking about it, that sometimes because of the way life is, there has not been the movement for their freedom as it has been for African Americans. Though they were not slaves, they were put on reservations and their land and things were taken. And so when people can come through that, when groups of people or individuals or families can come through that, that is a blessing that somehow you've been chosen to do something, you do what you do. And I think the most gratifying thing is that when people come up to you and say, thanks, man, or you make it happen, that's the kind of reward. And so I am lucky and feel blessed that my family has been able to see some of the fruits of the movement, that my mother and my dad and my brothers and sisters have been see some of the fruits of their children and their nieces and nephews in terms of the opportunities that we've had, they didn't have, and that we were able to take advantage of. And so I think it is something to shout about for my family.
Your response brings up one final question for me. For 6 or 8 years, your family was thrown into the civil rights movement, and I'm guessing that there were gains made. Certainly not the final goal was reached. So at what point were your family able to start making more time? Was it a goal had been reached, or how did that conclusion get arrived at?
I think that my dad was not in good health. He had a bad heart. And as my dad got older, my mother recognized that. And they just felt that should not have to continue to carry this banner, that you had reached a point where schools were integrated, that they were hiring blacks. They were elected, you could elect black officials. And when you get to those points, I think they felt that there is still a ways to go, but it is not the rod that we should carry. We should not lead the fight. We can support it, we can be supported, we can be inspirational, but at some point, we've done as much as we can do, and we need time. And I think that at some point, anybody needs time, just to have some time for themselves, have time for family. We miss so much, as I'm sure so many other people who have families and wives or husbands who have somebody active, you miss so much of that person, of knowing about that person, of being able to share little things, of being able to sit down and watch a TV program as a family and laugh and enjoy it. You just miss it because you're out doing something for a cause. And at some point, just to be able to come together and feel yourself as a family, and the noted value of the importance of family, that you have to reinforce those values and reinforce those. And if you're continuing to do that movement stuff, then you don't do that because you're at this meeting, you're at that meeting. You wanted to talk about this project. You're on this committee. And I think one of the things that my dad found that it was important for him was to, and my mother, was that they began a new role. And that was they began a role of sharing information. That my nieces and nephews all had some of the best education that there were. And they went to some of the better schools in the country. But they had a sense of who they were. They had a sense that they were Black. I can remember two incidents. One, my niece was at a school called Country Day in New Orleans, which is the best private school in the city of New Orleans, where all the millionaire kids went. And my sister and her husband made great sacrifices. Though he was a lawyer, he didn't have that kind of money, so they had to make sacrifices to send him there. And I remember the question that one day a teacher asked my niece. She says, Tamika, why don't you tell the class what it's like to be Black in New Orleans? She said, well, why don't the class tell me what it's like to be white, and then I'll tell them what it's like to be Black. And so they sent her to the office, and they wanted to disciplinary her. But she said, my papa told me that nobody can just order me or maybe say, if they ask you a question, you can ask them a question. And if they asked me a question, I had a right to ask them a question. She wanted me to tell the class something, so I wanted the class to tell me something. And so when my niece at my dad's funeral, at his wake, lots of people were talking about what my dad meant to them. And my niece, which I thought gave the best answer, she said, you know, the thing that I appreciate most about Pawpaw is that he allowed us to argue, he educated us, he taught us. He says, you know, I went to Princeton, I went to Country Day. He said, I work for a law firm. He said, and when I'm around certain Black kids, they laugh and they talk to me and they say, oh, you talk like a white kid, or you talk like the middle class Blacks. And she says, I say to them, I'm all of that and I'm Black. And I know more about being Black than you can ever. And she said, and I challenge them. She said, I'm secure about being Black. I know what it's like to be Black. I know what it's like to be Black and to be discriminated against, because I've had that happen. I know what it's like to be Black because my papa has showed me, and I know what they've been through. She says, so I am secure in being Black. I am secure about being the best Black that I can be in terms of being a Black American. She said, I make no apologies. And she said, and I still go back and I still volunteer and I tutor kids in inner cities. She says, I have no problem with being Black. And she says, and my challenge is that when people come to me and say, you sound like you act like you're white. And I say, well, what are you doing to be Black? You know, what are your contributions to the Black community? And I think that for my dad and my mom and my brothers and sisters, I think that is the role that they took on after they came out of the movement. That they took on reinforcing to the family the importance of being Black and the privileges you have that they fought for and we fought for, and that you don't take them and walk around with your head up in the air, that you went to Yale or you went to Princeton or you went to Colgate, Cornell, Syracuse, and forget from whence you came. You know, that you grew up and that you still ought to be able to walk into some place and sit down with a family and eat a bowl of cornbread and beans and enjoy them, as opposed to being able to eat a steak at Martin's. And so I think that's the road that they took on. And now I think that my brothers and my sister particularly have taken on the task of trying to share to a bigger part of the country the role that an incredible man and woman, my mom and my dad, and a family, and its efforts to make a contribution to make things better for this country.
Chuck Hicks, thanks for sharing your time and thanks for sharing your stories.
It's been my pleasure.